Hey, everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. Two awesome sponsors this week, lynda.com, L-Y-N-D-A. It's a huge online training resource. Get your 7-day free trial at lynda.com/shoptalk. And Artifact Conf, coming to somewhere that Scott Gell at least knows of, called Boston, but it's about an hour away from Boston in Providence, Rhode Island. I don't know. That was a weird segue.
Nailed it.
Environments for Human. It's going to be an awesome place thing going on. We'll tell you about both of those things later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Oh, I stopped it. Let's try again.
It's going to be a good week.
Good week right here. That's how it all happens.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about frontish, endish, webish, designish, and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. And with us, we have Mr. Scott Gell. Hey, Scott.
Hey, everybody.
I love that.
Nice.
You should keep doing that. Anyway, so Scott, at Scott Gell on Twitter, J-E-H-L, a Filament Group employee. Is that correct? Is that still correct? That's your main
gig?
That
is still correct, yeah.
Right on.
Been a while, actually.
The reason I was so confused in the beginning was that's Boston, right?
Yes.
And then it says Florida on your Twitter profile.
Yep.
And Boston on your Skype profile.
And then today we talked and you're in the Central Time Zone, which Florida is not in the Central Time Zone. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying out that newfangled remote working thing.
So you're in Iowa. I have no idea.
You know, it varies by the week.
Oh,
yeah. I'm in Seagrove Beach, Florida, which is in the Panhandle. So it's far
enough east that it is in the Central Time Zone.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it changes around what Tallahassee, I think. But anyway, on Central Time.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Cool. And so, Yogi, you've worked for Filament Group for a long time. Filament Group does all kinds of cool JavaScript stuff as well as just, it's kind of a consultant thing, right? They had a lot to do with the Boston Globe thing, and that's done now, so I'm sure you're doing other cool stuff.
Yeah, we do, you know, client services work, do a lot of open source work, you know, it's sort of...
It just doesn't feel like an agency when you go to the Filament Group website, you know? It's not just like hey, we help you build websites, but that is what you do, right? It's essentially an agency.
That's absolutely what we do, yeah.
Cool.
Yep.
You guys should put a picture of a guy shaking hands with a lady, you know, in front of a skyscraper.
Stock photography, have you heard of it?
Oh,
I think that would really up your image.
Yeah, attract some new clients.
Yeah, get them.
But you're known for Scott and Filament Group are like large, like progressive enhancement would be a big word to associate with you guys. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. We've done a lot of work in that area. Wrote a book on the topic.
Yeah,
a few years
absolutely.
Back.
And so, if a new client came to you, and would you? Do they come to you because of that philosophy already, or is it? Or would you try to sell them on that idea, or how does that go down?
Yeah, I think early on it was more that they came to us needing, you know, just general website help. And you know, we had this sort of methodology in place, and we would kind of teach and you know, I guess, so to speak, sell them on that. But it's changed over time. Largely because of projects that we've had that we've built in that way and sort of attracted new work through those projects. So yeah, we're pretty fortunate now. I think we get a lot of clients who come to us sort of pre-sold on the idea that they need this thing. And, you know, we're happy to help.
That's cool. That's like a good version of being pre-sold on something, right? Where it might be a little different if you're like a Drupal shop and a client comes to you and be like, hey, I know you guys use Drupal, so can you make my website in Drupal, please? And some people have an issue with that because you're like, whoa, can we please talk about what you need as a company before we start talking about which CMS we're going to use? But when it comes to progressive enhancement, it's just like always a good idea, right?
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, to clarify, I don't think we necessarily get so many clients that come to us and say, we need progressive enhancement.
Yeah, sure.
You know, an unobtrusive JavaScript and all that kind of stuff. It's more like we need something that works everywhere. So,
yeah.
You know, what do you guys do for that? But yeah, occasionally we'll get, you know, some of our clients actually have in-house dev teams, actually a lot of them do, that we end up collaborating with, and they're sort of familiar with those practices ahead of time. So yeah, sometimes clients do come to us saying those specific things as well. But yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you had some work with jQuery Mobile.
I did. Yeah. Yeah, we're not so much working on that project anymore. The team has sort of transitioned and it's still going strong. But yeah, a couple years ago, we were leading the project up until early this year. Yeah, that was a fun project. We learned so much. I mean, so many devices that, you know, we were able to have access to through that project that really informed the way we build things, you know.
Is it still like a thumbs up kind of like if somebody's like, hey, you know, I need to save some time here. Is there a go-to framework I can use to kind of help me out on this cross-device stuff? That would still be a endorsement.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know how it is with frameworks. I mean, there's always a trade-off with convenience to, you know, what you get out of it. And I think that's, you know, that's true of that framework or any framework, jQuery too, right? But yeah, we still use it, you know, on occasions that where it makes sense. And it's super handy for prototyping. One thing I think, you know, kind of the biggest thing that came out of that project for me is it gave me all these little tools and techniques and practices that ended up spawning their own sort of individual smaller projects. So a lot of filament groups, open source repos are sort of just like pieces that we learned from jQuery Mobile and slimmed down and, you know, maybe made independent of jQuery itself and easy to port. Yeah. But yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Very
cool.
Solid project, solid team.
Some of those might be, I don't know which ones exactly are, but like, for example, the orientation change thing was kind of spearheaded by possibly you, which was a weird one.
I mean, thank goodness I guess it's sort of cropping up again this week with, with iOS 7, but, yeah.
Is it back?
It's sort of, I'm really actually kind of confused on the state of things, but PPK has been writing a couple posts. Maybe you guys.
The one that said don't use with equals device with anymore. Use the whatever one.
Yeah. See, that was yesterday, but there's a new one today.
You retracted that statement.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Well, it had a pretty bold words in there about IE10, which, you know, apparently that was the one problem with that thing. And he just straight up said Safari iOS is more important than iOS, you know, so use this. And I'm like, that's a bold words, kind of, you know. It probably depends on the project.
Yeah, I mean, it's always kind of risky building anything on the sort of just non-standardized way that they're handling these tags. But
we may have lost a few people though, so maybe we should back up just, and we don't have to spend this long on one of them. There's this thing because I don't understand it entirely as well. Let me put forth a scenario, if I may. Let's say you have a website and you're making a mobile version of it or whatever, right? And you have very little CSS on the page, just a couple of paragraphs of text. If you put as a meta tag in the head, like meta viewport, whatever, with equals device with, and then open it on, let's say, your iPhone with Safari, if you have that in the head, it will kind of like the actual document will be 320 pixels wide or whatever, right? It will kind of look properly. It won't have that zoomed out, you know, 960 or whatever it is, where the text will be really tiny. It will kind of look like a zoomed in version of that, which is good. That's what you're looking for generally when you use that tag. Then you flip it sideways And it's still, it like maintains that 320, right? It kind of like the, if there's font in there, it'll look bigger on the screen because it like zoomed in a little bit.
Right.
Is that what you're trying to prevent, or you're trying, is that good?
Well, I think that's the new problem that he described yesterday. And then today he says, oh, wait, actually, this doesn't cause a problem at all. I'm not really sure. I need to reread those posts again to fully understand it. The classic problem, and the one that you referred to earlier that we built a workaround for, was in iOS, if you had a website pulled up in portrait mode and then you flipped it to landscape, the page would bust out of the dimensions of the screen.
So you would have to give you a horizontal scrolling, really?
Well, it was zoomed in past, yeah. So you would have to pinch out to get
back. It would
have been
back, like,
right?
a 480 site zoomed in to 320 or whatever. So
weird.
Yeah. Something. Yeah. Like so you'd have to, you know, zoom out. So the workaround. Well, I guess, you know, the faulty workaround was, okay, you could just, you know, disable the ability to zoom into the page, and that problem would go away. But of course, that introduces a bigger problem, right? That you can't zoom. So,
yeah.
So the workaround that we made at the time was, it would listen to the device motion sensors and sort of detect when, an orientation change was about to happen. And when that happened, it would lock zoom, prevent zoom from working. And then during the internet, the change, it would, you know, it would just sort of fix itself. And then we'd just remove that zoom prevention again once it finished. And it was, you know, hacky. It worked well. But this was something that, you know, at the time, like Boston Globe really wanted this bug to go away when their site launched, right? Because it was really confusing for iOS users, I think.
Certainly, so. Yeah. What a bad bug. And then they kind of fix it. I mean, it's like weirdly huge bug.
Yeah, and we filed it very early on in the Apple tracker, but of course that's, you know, it's a black box, so you never know. Never know. But anyway, yeah, I guess the problem is back in some capacity now. I haven't really read up on it. I'm not so sure I'd be so keen on working around it with JavaScript anymore either, but, you know.
So you also made PictureFill and Respond.js. And one of these was made on a raft in Thailand. Which one was that?
In parts, probably both of those, yeah. Yeah, my wife and I took off and traveled in Asia for 8 months or so. And yeah, I was really lucky to be working on open source stuff at the time. So a lot of those projects were receiving commits in the middle of the night here in the States. But
just cruising down a raft.
That's pretty nice. I find these JavaScript people like you, they kind of have these little like international travel peace outs. You and Ashkenaz are like, see ya.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't really avoid work for too long, but
cool. So maybe we can talk about some of those things, or maybe they'll come up in questions later. Sure. Unless, Dave, you wanted to dig into one of them.
No, no. I don't picture Bill. It's today's a bad day to ask about it, but just there's a lot of chatter in the responsive images community group today. But anyway, I don't want to go down that path. Oh man.
They like officially decided that picture's out, right? It's kind of like
they want to make it a note.
Oh, okay.
A footnote. On SourceN or something. Mm. Anyway, don't get me started.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very nice that we're sort of, you know,
progressing somewhere.
Yeah, and debating syntax mm-hmm. between viable solutions at this point. You know, for me, viable was always something that could be polyfilled safely without making a couple requests when it shouldn't. Mm-hmm. So, you know, SourceN does that pretty well. Preferences aside, it's good to see that we've got some viable options, I think.
But ordinal attributes, not a thing. Should it be? Should it be?
Mm.
That's a tough question. That's where I'm stuck. I'm just.
Well,
like,
I liked the blog post about it because it, you know, it very succinctly laid out what the problems and desires are, and then came up with a solution, and then says, here's how this solution solves all those desires. I mean, whether you like it or not, at least the thinking was pretty laid out well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I find that a lot of the arguments for SourceN deal with problems that we haven't necessarily encountered in our own work. So I have a little trouble identifying with some parts of that, like the repetition of images and things like that. But, you know, I can see that it could be a little more compact in the end, and that's good. So, I mean, sure. Yeah.
Cool.
I'm glad to see it moving on, really.
Yeah, we just need something.
Yeah.
So let's move on. We got bigger fish to fry.
We can't not mention this because it was such an incredible topic. The Twitter was loaded with it the past couple of days, and that was the GoDaddy acquisition of Media Temple and how I feel like it's worthy of the hot drama here just because of how crazy of a pairing it is, and that it's just so ubiquitous in our industry that just generic GoDaddy hate. And Media Temple is generally loved, especially in the last few years. I think maybe when Media Temple just started, there was some growing pains. Maybe wasn't as universally loved. But now you hear very little but love for Media Temple. So how crazy is it that all of a sudden Media Temple is like, oh, hey, we were purchased by GoDaddy? It was crazy, right? I don't know. It was weird to me.
Yeah, I found it weird.
I for one support our new elephant shooting overlords.
There's at GoDaddy and at Media Temple are just all over the social media world, and everybody and lots of other people that work for them too just given the pitch just right and left, and it's getting a little obnoxious. I think the like, don't worry, Media Temple is staying at an independent organization.
Yeah, we're still autonomous, says no one 5 years later.
Yeah, you're like, listen, we've seen this happen before. I've been a part of these things. I've been a part of acquisitions where it's just all happy roses on day one. And it's like things change. They just are going to change, period.
Oh, I mean, like straight up, it's like shareholders, like managers or people who've been there a long time. They're like, cash money, I'm out. Peace. Like, we got acquired.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's what happens. I don't know. So there's going to be a huge management shift. That's what's weird. I just wonder if Media Temple, like every time I call to be like, my server's off, if they're going to be like, that's cool. Did you want to buy email? You know,
like, not at first, at first it will be fine and then it will change. I mean,
unusual domain names, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. Did you know you could also get .biz? Yep, I was aware. Thank you. I don't know. Dave Rupert .biz sounds pretty good.
There was a lot of hot drama, just kind of hate over the whole situation. Very unhappy people just jumping ship immediately. And I queued in, and, you know, this is unique to me. So, but this is, you know, it's partly my podcast here, so I feel like I'm gonna just mention it. I wrote a post about it like right away because I had plenty of thoughts about the whole thing, and it wasn't as I'm not as like filled with hate about this as possible. And it's an experience that's completely unique to me and the things that I've been through. And at one point, the domain name, which I registered through GoDaddy because I just always have for whatever, and I like that all my domains are just in one place. It's like if I'm gonna move, I want to move all of them and not anyway. They're all just happened to be on GoDaddy. At one point, it was stolen, and it was transferred from one domain register to another domain register to another domain register. Apparently, this is how domain thieves do it. And if you want to steal a website, this is how you do it, right? Because then you own it. You control it. You can point the name servers wherever you want to put it. You can put as much spam on there as whatever. That's how you steal a website, is steal its domain registration. And it was a huge, huge hot drama problem. Right. It was kind of out of my hands at one point. It's and people had to fight really legally fight and work with other organizations and do tricky back end stuff and kind of get it done. And it just was confusing and frustrating for me. And GoDaddy really went to bat for me. A team at GoDaddy got together and they fought this battle and won it for me and got it back to GoDaddy and then helped secure it. And I talked with them the whole time and I was so pissed when it was happening. You know, it's so tempting to blame GoDaddy right away, but I looked at all the facts and stuff. It really ended up not being GoDaddy's fault. The people that were working for me were really doing a good job. So in the end, it was like normal, hardworking, good people at GoDaddy went to battle for me and mine. And it, you know, that was awesome. And I love them to this day for supporting it. My career is better because of it. So I was kind of a fan, and I've always been a fan of Media Temple anyway, because I think they do good work. And I was like, listen, this is my experience. I don't mind this at all. But I pointed out in the article, you know, literally their ex-CEO hasn't been their CEO for a couple of years, did kill an elephant. So if you're a huge elephant lover, which I think everyone is.
He fed it to a village. I don't know if that makes it better.
Did he feed it to the village?
Yeah.
Well, okay. I mean, okay. Maybe we'll skip
the elephant. It's not a rad situation.
No, but it's not like he licked a knife with his tongue and went in there and just murdered any old elephant. That, from what little information I was able to read about the thing, it was like the elephant was causing problems in the area and whatever. And anyway, it's not illegal to do what he did. So if you hate it, that's fine. I don't like it either. I would never kill an elephant. I wouldn't even kill I have a skunk in my backyard that I won't even kill. but it's, you know, people, you can have other hobbies. There can be such a thing as diversity in the world. Anyway, let's skip that. The women thing is a big issue, which I was wrong about in my post, and I need to kind of update, and that it's not just they use hot, attractive women in advertising. It's deeper than that. So I have to correct some of that stuff, but those are, you know, there's a new CEO.
Tasteless.
It's been years ago. They've gotten rid of most of that stuff. There's some lingering stuff on the site still, but all those ads are gone, and there's new ads coming in that are just not like that at all. So anyway, there's changes afoot or whatever, and I'm not trying to be an apologist for elephant killing and misogyny, but my experience is when you go to battle for me and mine, I'm in your corner. So that's the Chris Coyer experience.
Sure. That makes sense.
I've had good experiences with Media Temple, even though like my server falls over occasionally. I still have a pretty good time with them. I don't think it would be dramatically better on another host. So I don't know.
Yeah. We don't currently host anything that I can think of with them. So I guess I don't really have a strong opinion. We'll have to see what Media Temple's Super Bowl ads look like this year.
Yeah.
Get a server, bro.
If they do something new after this that's awful, let's all jump ship. If it's fine or better, let's not. You know, like, can we be pragmatic about this? Okay.
That's fair.
Hot drama.
All right. Let's get into the meat and potatoes of the Shop Talk show.
Let me do a sponsor, right? Because we're 26 minutes into this,
right? Let's get into the cash money of the Shop Talk show.
I know I've been talking for forever, but let me just give me the one more thing, right? Lynda.com, LYNDA.com/shoptalk is how you get your free 7 days of this, and it's like the biggest learning resource there is on the web. It's video based training, but there's like exercise files that go along with every single series, right? So I have a course on there. It's about WordPress theming. Every single video has all the files for the video, like in step by step things. So you can you're constantly downloading the files and seeing what's changed and whatever. And it's kind of nice. You know, it's like any topic there is in the world, all this web stuff you can learn on there, but it goes well beyond that. And there's stuff about, you know, photography and running a business and all that stuff. It's pretty cool. I have a course on Backbone open right now. It's one of those things that I'm just addicted to reading about and not using. Not that I have any problem with it. I just need to I need to grasp it. I need to grasp things really deeply before I go for it. But I've started watching it already. So thanks, Linda, for helping me learn about that. Yeah. Anyway, they have a new course every single day. There's 2,000 courses on Lynda.com. But okay, I just need to shut up about it now. Go through it. It's good service. It's not even it's a lot cheaper than college, I'll tell you that. Okay.
Awesome.
Got a question, Dave? Right. Let's have it.
Yeah, here we go. Mark Krakowski writes in, I'm developing a new responsive site for a client and want to use a mobile-first approach because I also use Foundation 4. But the client wants to see the desktop version first, and I should build the mobile look after that because of the deadline stuff. How do you solve this little problem?
That's pretty weird, right? So the client's like dictating which version they build first. That's pretty tough.
Like which version they design first?
It sounds like
it, yeah. I couldn't really tell.
It doesn't say design, but the client wants to see the desktop version first. So it just says see, so I guess you could just do it however you want and only show them the But doesn't that feel a little dangerous? Because maybe they don't like the mobile version that you started with in secret.
Body min width 960 pixels.
Right.
I don't know. This is tough.
Yeah, I mean, there's the mobile first design kind of philosophy and arguments, right? Like the Luke W side of things, where there's all the benefit of, you know, that hyper focus of starting mobile first. You sort of like end up with less unnecessary cruft in the end on the desktop version too. So I think there's some value to that. I'm not really doing Luke a good service here, but there's a lot more to it than that. But then I don't know, from the dev side, I think mobile first development kind of lends itself to other development methodologies pretty well, like progressive enhancement, right? Like you're starting with something kind of like minimal and layering things on, whether that's, you know, layering on columns in a visual sense or layering on features. I don't know. At least mentally for me, I think mobile first development, CSS, that sort of thing, makes a lot of sense in that way.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of, I always say it's like treating pixels as a feature that other devices don't have.
Right. Whatever.
It's like, oh, this one has more pixels.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think there's more opportunity.
Group, oh, go ahead. At Filament Group, when you guys are like designing and presenting stuff for the client, like, do you guys show the desktop version first, or do you guys just show a tube of content first, or how does that, or do you do a tube of content with an arrow out to the big one, or how do you guys kind of sell that?
I think typically our early wireframes are already sort of in a, not necessarily a polished design direction, but we work in Illustrator and we'll usually have, we'll start with the mobile, sure, because then you get sort of the content priorities in order. And our first time that we present to the client, we'll usually show a variety of ways that the content might be presented. So, you know, whether that's like two breakpoints to start with, just to sort of show how the content might adapt across different screens. I don't think we typically show one first or the other first, though.
Sure. That makes sense. Maybe that'd be a compromise, Max. You could show them both. Instead of just being like, hey, you know what? We work the opposite way. We'll show you what we show you, or trying to have a conversation about that you might lose. You could show them both instead. And you know what? There might be a way to design in a mobile first kind of way, but spend the most time getting right and getting approval on the desktop version. Just because you're showing them the desktop version first doesn't mean like the grid structure that you use couldn't have a mobile first approach baked into it.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe it sounds like he's trying to like the client also is trying to cut a corner or something and wants, he's like, no, do mobile afterwards. It's not as important.
Some education there probably wouldn't hurt either. Just explain them why you might go this way, because we see benefit in it. So maybe you can communicate that benefit to them. And if you lose every battle, well, it's their money too. I mean, there's that kind of idea at first too. I mean, we can try to protect the internet as best we can, but you also have a business here, so.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are technical arguments too, I think, for starting small and scaling up. You know, like an older, really low featured mobile device would probably do better with, you know, receiving a basic kind of linearized, if you will, layout than a desktop layout that somehow has to like degrade itself down to work on that device.
Yeah. That's the education part, right? You could explain that. Be like, well, this is going to be kind of awesome. You're going to get deeper reach if we do it this way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Well,
I'm wondering, can you set, so I'm like making a code pen right now. free advertising, Chris.
Cha-ching.
But can you set that meta viewport to like width 1080 pixels or something?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So like, you could straight up build it on Foundation and then just like make the viewport super big.
Yeah, Bob, like
Bob's your uncle. He doesn't know because you know, and explain you built it on a foundation for mobile support or blah blah blah, and then you just don't give it to him. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. Like I think it was the New York Times website that used to do something like that, where it would set the viewport zoom level or width in such a way that you'd kind of land on the first column of a multi-column layout.
Oh, interesting.
So you could actually still pan, but you were sort of like at the relevant content, at least.
Yeah.
Oh, clever. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's kind of like a stopgap.
Yeah. That's what everything is almost.
Yeah. I don't, I would, I mean, it depends on how much FaceTime you have with the client, but I would just be like, I don't need, you know, I'm not here to tell you how to run your business, but you're going to want that mobile website for the next 5 years, you know, that desktop site.
Yeah, that's another important thing, right? Is longevity of this thing. That's a good idea.
And that viewport thing does work. I just did it. So.
Good.
Yeah.
There you go.
Mr. Charlie Cathcart asks, I am trying to understand web templating, specifically via JavaScript. I've heard of mustache and handlebars, but I'm not sure how it's implemented. For the most part, I'm not working on large sites. What are the pros, cons of it, and how can it be implemented, and how can I find out if it's worthwhile for the project that I'm using?
That's a tricky question.
So,
I mean, there's a lot of parts to it.
Yeah, it's like, first, I guess we could start with, like, what the heck is JavaScript templating? It's front-end templating, right? It's templating that happens on the client as opposed to the server.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, in a basic sense, it would be kind of looking at something that that sort of looks, sort of resembles a classic server-side template, right? Where it's yeah, got it's the like, markup, but the portions that would have content are sort of variabilized.
It's like PHP or something, but it runs on the client, like on the phone or on the computer, you know, after DOM ready or whatever.
Right.
You could maybe make it faster. But so it's like a template that people, you can build in JavaScript, and it's mustache and handlebars. It's a little bit like writing a bunch of jQuery or whatever to like, you know, div this thing in the content, the text is this, and you build up a string. It's a little bit like doing that, but programmatically. But, like,
yeah, much better too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And probably
to maintain, right? Faster. It's kind of taking this, instead of like putting all your HTML and stuff all up in your JavaScript, it kind of separates it out a little bit. It's still JavaScript, but it's like this, it's like a template, right? It's like an easier, it's like an abstracted chunk of stuff that stays away from your business logic, as it were. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge step above, you know, crawling through DOM elements and appending here and replacing this and adding this, you know.
Yeah, possibly as an abstraction to help with the spaghetti problem.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it's hugely helpful anytime you're updating the DOM. I think sort of the holy grail that we're trying to get to with the client-side templating stuff is to be able to serve a website markup, you know, from the server in a classic way, and then bind data to that markup and update from there with client-side templating. So something like Backbone or whatever. And it's totally doable today. It's just not, it's not very common because it's,
which,
you know,
would eliminate the need kind of for something like mustache or handlebars, because the HTML already is the template.
Possibly. Yeah,
it's kind of that's kind of like the long way around to get like total support. You know, I think most people right now are just like, must add, get some data, like from tweets, let's call them tweets. They're getting some tweets and they're like mustache, spit it out on the page. JavaScript loops through 100, 200 times, spits out a template, you know?
Yeah.
But right. that, but what you guys want to do, because again, the progressive enhancement stuff is like, try to get the support baked in on the server as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are a couple arguments for it. There's a performance argument for serving markup, you know, from the server. Like the classic example, I think, was Twitter. That used to be client-side templated and quite slow, right? I mean, you used to go to the Twitter website and you would see sort of like the skeleton of the page and a loading icon. And yeah, and it would...
Really?
For me, it would take several seconds before it spun up.
And that's with just sending data, which should be faster, but sending actual HTML turned out to be faster.
Right, and of course, you know, that could have a lot to do with their particular implementation of client-side templating and not necessarily the technique itself. But they had an article that showed when they switched away from client-side templating, you know, they were shaving seconds off their loading time.
Wow.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the cost of client-side templating is that there's a larger hit up front, right? Even in a modern browser, you're sort of loading a lot more than you need to up front so it can parse all this stuff.
And what you're loading up front is the library mustache, right? That's the hit, is that you need this library.
Yeah, alongside, you know, depending on how far you go down the MVC path, you might have Ember or Backbone or, you know, something like that in there.
But then once it's there, theoretically, it's quicker.
Yeah, right. So that's the advantage. I mean, if you're in a modern browser that, you know, these frameworks work well in, then after that initial hit, it's going to be very fast. I mean, if you go to like that new website Bustle, for example, that's built with Ember, and it's amazing how fast the articles spin up page to page once you're loaded. But, you know, a lot of criticism went around when that site launched, or really any, you know, client-side MVC site that goes up and launches, that, you know, if you turn off JS, you just get a blank page. And it's not really about, you know, people who sit there and turn off JavaScript, but that sort of single point of failure is, you know, it's a very serious concern on the cross-device web, right?
The best example might be healthcare.gov, which just launched or whatever, mm-hmm. and they used a little bit of this MVC stuff. Yeah, and people literally cannot get healthcare because this JavaScript call to populate a select box doesn't work.
Right. Yeah.
So it's just this like, I mean, I don't know. I just thought it was interesting. There are all these debates about progressive enhancement and JavaScript MVC going around, and I'm very moderate on the subject, but it was, you know, then healthcare.gov comes out and then everyone's like, oh, it's not working because it's so highly trafficked or whatever. And that's totally wrong. It was just crappy. So I don't know. So maybe it was crappy and that's why the MVC stuff didn't work, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. But
Charlie, go ahead.
I was just, you know, to cap that off, I mean, the client-side templating and MVC stuff is it's really great to work with. I think for us, we're trying to push the developers of these frameworks in a direction where we can serve markup and then bind to it, and you know, and use those frameworks because they're just awesome to work with. But you know, it's kind of early days for that stuff still. I think Airbnb has done some really great work with that. I'm not sure if it was on Backbone or Ember. Do you guys know?
Backbone, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's all possible, and we've been prototyping with it in-house with our limited Backbone capabilities, and we've found that it's totally doable, too. So, I mean, it's just not as common. It's more work, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like, I mean, you know, if you talk about markup, it's like double the markup. You need a server renderer and a client renderer. You can kind of recycle some of that in Node, but you know, that's a pretty specific architecture or whatever.
Yeah,
but it's a tough problem. I don't know, hopefully that helps, Charlie.
Hope so.
When do you use it? Not on the healthcare site.
Indeed. It. Charlie, if you're in a situation where there's lots of Jason being thrown around too and you have no control over that, that's a situation where you're pretty much going to need to use some kind of client-side templating. So that would be your, you know, if you have no idea like whether you need it on your project or not.
Are you doing it on CodePen, Chris? Is it?
Occasionally, you know, when it's appropriate or whatever. A lot of times we, you know, it's a Rails thing. So like if like a new comment gets added to the page or whatever, we actually just send back HTML, you know,
mm-hmm.
and just
and inject that back in.
Right.
Cool.
Which right. is,
yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. But like when you load the page for the first time, they're just there in HTML, right? It doesn't send the page a bunch of JSON of these comments and then let the client do it, you know. Largely mm-hmm. it's just a page of content.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see. We got the Artifact Conference. That's a thing that's coming up. Artifactconf.com, Providence, Rhode Island. Lovely town, I've heard.
Oh my.
Dave's gonna be there. You can save $100 off of going to it if you want by using coupon code SHOPTALK. So it's an in-person conference put on by Environments for Humans, right? Ethan's going to be there. Everybody loves Ethan, right? Keynoting it. He'll probably talk about maps and stuff. It's pretty good. I've heard it. Yeah, it really is. It's good. There's some clever tricks in there that you should be aware of that I can't ruin for you. You have to go to Artifact Conference to get it. There's going to be workshops there if you want to really dig in and kind of spend some extra full day time and learn with somebody or like bring your team from work or whatever. There's responsive one, two different ones. There's responsive patterns with Brad Frost. There's build responsive with Ben Callahan, which is awesome. There's a SAS one by Matt Griffin and animations and CSS by Val Head. So you can deep dive or you can go for the day and just have that awesome conference experience. Artifactconf.com.
And I'll be there and we can hang out and drink responsibly together.
So. And we didn't talk about Scott's book. Is that, or I mean, it's not out yet, right? But you're working on it, right?
I am working on it. Yep. Yeah.
Responsible.
Yes. It's with A Book Apart. Mm-hmm. And it's called Responsible Responsive Design. So it kind of, you know, builds upon Ethan's book and Ethan's work on responsive design. And I think it merges it with other responsible practices, right? Performance, accessibility, and more so than just accessibility in the sense we commonly talk about it, but just generally access, right? Being able to get to something. Usability and sustainability of our code bases. So kind of all those parts
good timing. Things that became big topics kind of post Ethan's book, you know, the what about this.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, it's really, you know, all these problems that we're dealing with, building sites that are supposed to be able to adapt and work across a variety of very different devices, and you know, they're only getting more different, so yeah. And cool. Yeah, so that'll be out at some point early next year.
Awesome.
I'm
sure we'll mention it on the show so people can get it. That's fabulous.
Pretty excited.
I want to run this one by you. Maybe this can make the book, or maybe you can shoot a hole in it. Michael Schofield writes in. One of the websites I now manage is an established spaghetti-coded academic department that I don't want to rework entirely just yet because, I don't know, it's a big old CMS and a redesign is on its way. That said, the faculty is starting to access the site from their phones and their tablets and stuff, but the menu is still hover-based. I need a quick temporary fix. Instead of throwing in a huge user agent detector, I wrote just a few lines to detect a mouse. This was suspiciously easy, and I'm wondering if you guys would comment on this. So this is totally Scott territory, I've decided. This is a four-step thing.
Events and binding.
Yeah. That is dangerous assumption territory.
Are you ready? I don't know. I don't know if this would work or not, but you might not know off the top of your head. I'm not trying to grill you, but we're here
pop
we go.
Quiz.
Here
we go.
Here
quiz.
We go.
All right.
Number one, listen for a mouse enter event on the main container. Then number two, chain a listener for a click, or, you know, add another event listener for a click on that same container. If the mouse enter happens anywhere on this container, then just set a variable like, hey, it's a mouse to true, because you won't get a mouse enter event otherwise. Yeah. And then number four, if a click happens, before that mouse enter, you can infer that it's a touch device. So wait for the mouse enter. If that happens first, it's a mouse. If the click happens first, it's a touch menu.
So the assumption is that because usually mouse events fire in order of, you know, down, over, up, then click, right? And enter falls somewhere usually before that. You know, it's more like the over step, right?
Right.
That would be before click.
There's mouse over and mouse enter, and they're like the same thing. Only one of them bubbles
up.
And one of them doesn't.
What I'm getting at is, on a touch screen, I think that event order tends to be preserved depending on the platform. So, like on iOS, you would get all those mouse events before the click fires. So I'm not sure about mouse enter.
Like even if you tap on something,
you're going to get a mouse enter succession of, you know, touch start, touch move, touch up, touch end, sorry. And then the mouse events, and it varies. Like some of the older Blackberries and things had, like, you know, the event order was a little different there, which was really interesting to work with on jQuery mobile. But, I will say that I really like where you're going with that. And I think it's pretty close to what we actually ended up having to do on the Lego site that just went up. So I don't know, maybe it's hard to say.
He says so far it's working without a hitch. So it'd be interesting to see Michael make a code pen. We'd like to check it out. It is, you know, it seems pretty clever to me, but I don't know. I mean, like even Scott mentioned things that, like, I didn't totally understand, like the fact that all these, like, other events fire in a particular order and stuff. I mean, that stuff's a little.
Yeah. I mean, that's just something you'd have to test and verify, yeah. I think, but.
It sounds like it gets more complicated. I feel like I've read articles that said, like, hey, touch support, darn near impossible to test for, kind of thing.
Well, it's tricky because a lot of devices that have touch support are not exclusively touch, right? So, I mean, this isn't even a new thing, but you have new laptops, like, you know, Windows 8 kind of laptops that you can touch the screen or use the keyboard. So that has mouse events and all sorts of different inputs you could plug into it. But yeah, a lot of older Androids, things like that, have the little roller ball on them, and that fires only mouse events, even though there's a touch screen right above it. So when you're using touch events, you have to normalize these in such a way that you're not just saying, oh, if touch is supported, we're just going to go forward with that. You have to actually listen for both and keep whatever bubbles up first and scrap the rest. So if a mouse event bubbles up first, then let's go ahead and use that. If a touch event comes up, we know a mouse event it could be coming right behind it. So we want to ignore that one if it happens to be on the same touch target. Otherwise you get, you know, double firings of taps and things like that. So yeah, it's pretty tricky, but I would say bottom line, it's really difficult or impossible to presume, things based on touch support, whether touch is going to be exclusively used or not, just because it's there.
Yeah, that's tough.
I had this really brutal situation like the other week where you would, on a Windows 8 Surface, a Microsoft Surface, you would touch the menu. Like I had hover and click, like, binded to the menu, right, for a drop-down menu.
Yeah.
You'd click it. Both hover and click would fire, so the menu would open, close, and then open, and then you couldn't close it. So I had to like hijack it with this like pointer, Microsoft navigation pointer sort of thing. I can post a blog post or whatever on it, but it was just like one of those things. It was just like, what? How do I get, you know, like hover and click on a menu is pretty simple, right? Ugh. Until.
Yeah, it's tricky, I think. I'll post the workaround that I've put together for Lego. I'll post that up so we can talk about it. It sounds similar to what you were talking about. Might be the same thing. I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe.
I have a scenario to put forth for you guys to comment on. It's dangerous though, because if I'm doing it wrong, it's embarrassing. But here's
danger,
the deal.
Danger, you say?
Well, go to codepen.io on a desktop or whatever. Because the point is, so there's your user icon in the upper right, in which has a menu. If you're logged in, mm-hmm. If you're logged in, there's a user menu in your upper right, and if you hover over it with your mouse, it opens up the drop down menu, and you can click. So it's a hover based drop down menu, right? If you go to it on your phone or a tablet and you click it, it just opens up the menu. I did nothing. I did no JavaScript. That's just what happens when you use that menu. Like, so why is that? That seems totally fine to me. I didn't do anything special because it works fine.
iOS, I think, did that really well. Like, they fire a hover event, I think, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the hover selector will work on a tap in iOS. The tricky thing is, I mean, in your case, it sounds like it's fine. But if it's a link that also happens to do something when you tap it, then it gets into sort of mucky territory, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a link. I mean, it goes to your profile, but it doesn't like it, you're saying like a JavaScript event or something. You bound.
No. Well, I was thinking more like when we've run into this in the past. Say it's a menu that also, like you said, goes to your profile when you click it, but opens on hover. A light tap on the screen would trigger the hover without actually clicking the link, but a sort of like a more forceful tap would actually go to the page.
Really?
Yeah, and it's kind of hard to, it's not something you'd expect the user to know to do. So.
Oh, certainly not.
But I don't know if you're running into that or not. I mean, that's what I've seen in the past. But yeah, hover does work.
That's like the fact of the day. I didn't even know there was two types of taps. I should be fired from this podcast.
Just making stuff up.
No, I'm sure there is. I got to try it now. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty good. And Michael, thanks for writing in with that idea. Let's, make a code pen. Let's talk about it. We got time for one more, Dave?
Yeah, we got one more. Let's see. Let's find a good one. We got a audio question.
That's sure.
Our favorite kind of question here on the Shop Talk Show. It comes in from Rob. I'm going to murder this. Wiersbowski. Lebowski. Nailed it. All right, let's see.
Mark it zero.
Oh, no. The dude took his... okay. We'll just have to read it. The MP3 file got taken down. Anyway, my name is Rob. I'm a web developer in Pittsburgh. In fact, a friend and I started a Pittsburgh SaaS meetup, Sassy PGH, a couple months ago. It's great. You guys should come visit. My question is about vanilla JavaScript performance and libraries. We all know that if you can write without a library, you should. It's faster in the browser. Nothing over the wire. Vanilla.js is the best. Everyone loves it. But what if you already have a library like jQuery running? Maybe because it's required for other parts of the application or someone else on your team is using it. Should you write as much as possible using plain JavaScript? I'm wondering if there are enough performance gains to outweigh the use of JQ shorthand and the maintenance benefit of having all your JS in a single syntax.
Yeah, so, I think there's obviously a huge maintenance benefit to having it all in the same syntax. I think, if the library's already there, then there's so much normalization and bug fixes and stuff that you can take advantage of. I would use it for sure. But I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to talk about in the abstract so much, right? So there's a jQuery function called like each or something, and you might somebody might show you a JS perf test that jQuery's each is slower than if you write a for loop and loop through them all or something. And
sounds like you're describing every pull request I get on GitHub.
But you'd be like, why would you do that when the API for jQuery's each is so clean and nice and probably normalizes some stuff that you're going to forget to do otherwise? Isn't that the argument?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, I guess if you build things and then when you're analyzing how the site is performing, if you notice bottlenecks and they happen to happen to be caused by the framework, then that would be cause for, you know, actually rewriting it. But I mean, this is outside of the question of whether you should be loading the framework at all and if you need it or not. But if it's there, I kind of think that's a decent way to approach it. But.
Yeah. It sounds like, Rob, you're like looking for rules, you know, looking for an answer that's like, you should do it this way. And I don't think anybody like wants to give you that rule, you know, cause it's just, that feels like dangerous territory. It feels like, you know, like a, just some law that you must abide by. And you're like, no, you should, you know, be more pragmatic than that or whatever. Like, look at actual problems and stuff like that. And tools, not rules or whatever. I know that's a little stretch of that little new phrase, but yeah, I would be hesitant to just tell you to do it this way without you thinking about it for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think at least from a maintenance perspective and familiarity of developers coming onto the project and knowing what's going on, sticking to a particular coding style is probably a good idea. So I don't know if that means, you know, never using native methods or not, because I certainly wouldn't recommend doing that as a rule. But yeah,
I think you also, like, with, you know, something like jQuery, you like, you're going to end up with less lines of code, you know. For example, like just to change like the HTML, like a class on the HTML element or something like that is kind of a lot of beefy code when it, you know, in HTML, it's like $ HTML, add class,
jQuery,
ninja. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Cause it's like, oh, just use class list. And you're like, yeah, that's fine. In if an IE10 plus or whatever.
Right. And then you add the polyfill and yeah.
It's like the classic, like just use regex sort of thing, you know. It's like, yeah, because that makes everything easier, just some me hacking away at some, you know, secret code that changes the web page.
I mean, libraries normalize so much that makes your job easier, so it's just a matter of, you know, if you're gonna go framework free, at least from my perspective, I always try to qualify things very heavily so I don't have to put in legacy workarounds. You know, because it, you know, presumably the JavaScript is layering on top of something that already works, right? So you can sort of, you know, put pretty high qualifications in there for whether or not the enhancements even, you know, need to run at all. And then you can use the new APIs. That's what we tend to do. Like Query Selector is kind of our cut the mustard bar, so to speak, for a lot of projects these days.
Yeah, I like the cut the mustard thing. That's the thing that I was alluding to in Ethan's talk, kind of, that I think people should be more familiar with.
Yeah, yeah, that was huge for us on the Boston Globe. We drew the line at media query support plus IE6 through 8 because we were polyfilling it at the time with Respond.js. And yeah, I mean, just knowing that that browsers that don't meet that criteria are probably not going to, you know, have this terrible experience from the JavaScript that comes after that line is a really nice safety mechanism.
So do you then, this is what I'm kind of curious about, and maybe we can talk about this off air a little bit too, because I have some like secret stuff I kind of want to ask. But like, let's say you decide that it passes this custom cut the mustard test, then you just do like, you know, $.git or in some, or like load script or whatever, like straight up Ajax in new stuff to use?
Somewhat, although we don't typically load jQuery up front.
Yeah, right. You use something else or whatever.
Yeah, so like where you said, you know, $.get or whatever, which would be something you could use if jQuery was there already. We would just have a function that basically just creates a script tag and
async. Yeah. And you're happy with that as a loading experience, right? Like every single time this is async loaded. Yeah, well, why not, right? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
why
for scripts, it works really well. You run into some situations where if you're really dramatically changing the appearance of the interface with JavaScript, then you have to deal with those situations where you don't want to show the initial content until it's kind of enhanced. I don't know. I find that's rarer and rarer. We're doing so much more with CSS these days, you know. But,
sure. And but you would do it with CSS too, right? Like what if it cuts the mustard? So you need, you know, you do something with
some
fancy JavaScript.
Like, yeah, absolutely. Like within CSS, we've been qualifying things with null media queries since, I don't know, a couple of years now. Like just
but you wouldn't load the new CSS. You would just, it would just already be available in the,
Well, yeah. I mean, we did a lot of experimenting with whether or not we could dynamically load CSS safely to kind of shave requests and precious bytes from devices that wouldn't be loading that CSS anyway, or rendering it rather. But we found that with CSS, it's a little different. The gains were not, at least at this stage, there was so much CSS shared across experiences, and it gzips so well.
Yeah,
it compresses
that's exactly
so well.
What I'm finding too.
Yeah, that CSS really works well to just like put it all in one pile, minify, gzip, you know, and send it as one request. But with JavaScript, I think it's a really different story. Like in the head of our pages, we typically just have you know, modernizer and a script that looks for feature tests and capabilities and then decides whether or not it's a good idea to load more JavaScript. And in those cases, the more JavaScript happens to be jQuery plus a load of, you know, other scripts that are using jQuery, you know, or whatever DOM framework we happen to be using. We don't always even use jQuery anymore, but yeah, I think that's a really good approach for scripting because, you know, with CSS, you really want it to be up front for the initial draw.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, yeah. I don't know, that it would be a weird loading experience if, for example, the first thing you did was a cut the mustard test, and then on the different forks of the cut the mustard, you then chose which style sheet you're going to dynamically load.
Right.
I feel like that would be weird.
Yeah, so the project that I did a lot of research on this in the past was called Essential, and it ended up having to use document write at the very end to, you know, you would have this style sheet reference that ended up being the one that you need to load. And if use document write, then it would still render progressively like you would expect a style sheet to load, you know, as opposed to if you loaded it asynchronously, then you'd see a flash of unstyled content.
So it's doable.
It's totally doable. But by doing that, you sacrifice the ability to, you know, let a browser prefetch that asset for one thing. Like it's going to be written by JavaScript and, you know, all the downsides of using document write. It's kind of cringeworthy, but in this case, you know, what we found was sort of interesting in a high latency mobile kind of environment, like an iPhone on a 3G connection. We were seeing, on a site like the Boston Globe, if we actually use this approach, we were seeing seconds in difference on like the first hit if we use this technique, versus loading everything. But on the desktop, we were seeing, like in Chrome, for example, on Wi-Fi, we were seeing actually like a slightly slower, we're talking milliseconds here, but slightly slower page load using the technique. So it was like, okay, do we make the site load like 2 seconds faster for mobile users at the expense of a couple milliseconds on the desktop? At the time, to me, it was very attractive. But I think, you know, looking at it from a sustainability perspective, I don't know if it's such a good idea, but yeah. So anyway, yeah, we've been just concatenating, minifying, gzipping CSS and just like, yeah, throw it down the tube. But
my experience on CodePen is like, you know, I'm going to put together a little performance budget, right? This was a thing that came up a couple months ago. Like, let's make sure that we have a plan for performance for this site and that we're never going to exceed X or whatever on this performance thing. And it's like, okay, let's see what we got for CSS here. On like a CSS heavy page, it's like 17K or something. You know, I'm like, okay, that'll fit. I think that'll fit in the budget, you know? And that's with like a lot of junk in there. Like we put SVG gradients in there for all the gradients we use. I'm like, man, if I just turned that off, this would be like way smaller than that even. Like CSS is like never a big part of the budget, I feel like.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's not so much a problem today as it will be years from now when we're writing more and more media queries to address only certain contexts, you know? So, I think maybe down the road it'll make more sense to have separate link elements and sort of break up our style sheets so that each link has a media query that sort of suggests the environment that the style sheet is supposed to apply in. And we can let the browser hopefully not load that style sheet or at least load it. Oh,
yeah, that would be awesome. That would be
yeah.
awesome.
Yeah, and that's kind of where things are going now anyway. Like WebKit already does deprioritize the loading of style sheets that have media attributes that don't apply. So if you put something on there that says like media equals, you know,
print.
Print is a good example. It will still load that style sheet, but it'll put it way low priority, after other more essential. Yeah. So it's kind of like,
in the parsing of it.
In the fetching. So it would not require for that asset to be loaded in order to show the page, from my understanding. So it's kind of like asynchronously loading it. It would be like the JavaScript defer attribute, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So would it be possible to do a cut the mustard, right? And the most extreme possible way, because I'm trying to extract knowledge from you here.
It's impossible to cut mustard. Just throwing that out there.
We have a mobile editor. It is a weird phrase, isn't it? We have a mobile editor on CodePen, and I quite like it. Right? It's server side ish. Right? It's totally different. It's a totally different set of JavaScript, HTML and CSS. All of those things are different. So I need to know on the server side whether I should serve it or not. So how I've done it so far, and I like this situation decently, is kind of like fake the client hints thing, is that make sure that there's always a cookie on the page if possible that has the cut the mustard test in it. And then on the server side, I can look at that cookie and see if the current situation is cut the mustardy or not. It's not even cut the mustard. It's in our case, it's like mobile or not, basically small screen or not. But the problem with that is it relies on a cookie, which some people have it turned off, and I'm not, you got to be careful not to get into an infinite loop kind of thing. And like the first time it's willing to be wrong. It doesn't like refresh the page if the cookie isn't there. It just is wrong that one time.
I mean, that's kind of the downside of all those approaches is, you know, the first load is.
It's particularly problematic in a world with like, I have a feed reader on my phone and I'll click over and open a link from the feed reader in there and then the cookie's not there because that's a different browser environment. Or then I'll go into Twitter and I'll open up maybe even that same link and be like, well, that's a different like sandboxed browser environment. So the cookie doesn't apply. It's a new world. You know, you're like,
way different.
Dang it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not great, but like if you did the cut the mustard technique on the front end and loaded everything else, like that was like everything, like the template, the CSS, the JavaScript, could you like fake a server side split on the front end? Or is that?
Oh, I mean, I think so. Yeah. I'm not looking at your code base, but
yeah, I know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the hard part would be if the markup is really dramatically different.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't just like load in. I mean, you could, but that would be a really weird loading experience, right? If you had to like Ajax in your entire page.
I wouldn't say that's always a bad idea, but yeah, I mean, like we've done a lot of sort of like separating out portions of a page that are deemed non-critical and Ajax including those in after the fact just to get that initial draw faster. But yeah, I mean, if the markup's different, then that's kind of the blocker, I think. Like anything else, assets can be negotiated on the client side. It's just
right. It's the markup.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. It needs to get easier, people. Anyway, that's a good place to leave it in this in this kind of, I like the client hints thing. I know you guys have some concerns about that, but for, I could use it right now. I'll tell you.
Oh man. I actually love it. I mean, my only concerns were, really less concerns and more like, doesn't quite have the things I need yet, but, you know, just portions of, information that could be sent. And Ilya's been very clear, it's just a starting point. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, just sending, device, screen size, screen width, to me resolution is not terribly useful because I tend to care, as you guys probably would agree, about the viewport size less than the screen size. But
oh, it's not really. It sends the literally what size is your entire like window dot width or whatever, or not even that. Like
I haven't checked up on it in probably a month or two, but that was the initial.
I think it's just been scaled down to DPR right now.
Okay.
At the moment.
Yeah, and something like that could give us some really useful information for negotiating an image or something. So I mean, that's awesome. But
I like it. I want it. I just don't understand how it's easier to roll out X headers like to every single browser.
Oh, sure.
And an element, God forbid, is super hard.
Right.
Never mind. I quit. Womp womp. All right.
Guys, the skunk guy just came and he left. I hope he got the skunk. I literally do have a skunk in my backyard.
My friends had a skunk and it dug under their house and had babies.
Yeah. See? That's what happens. Oh, it's terrible. Three times Digby's getting skunked.
Varmints, man. Yeah. Varmint. All right. Well, we're over time. Hey, Scott Jill, thank you so much for coming on the Shop Talk Show. For
so
those
much
who aren't already following you, how do they follow, if people follow you, give you money, do that stuff?
My Twitter, as mentioned earlier, just my full name, Scott Jell, no spaces or anything. Do they even allow spaces? Anyway, and GitHub, same thing, /Scott Jell. You can check out projects. Actually, a lot of them are /filamentgroup, and yeah, go to filamentgroup.com. That's where we're writing.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. And then buy your book whenever it comes out.
Yes. It should be early next year. Yeah, very exciting.
There we go.
Yep. Threw a
awesome
book apart.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you again, Scott,
so
for coming
me
on the show. And thanks, everyone, for coming out in the chat room. You guys are a lot of fun. Thank you, everyone, for downloading this on your phones or your computers. Be sure to rate us in iTunes or whatever software you use. We really appreciate that. And Chris, you got anything else left to say?
Hopped up, shoptalkshow.com.